The forces of the People's Army and Air Force were finally ready to carry out their sweeping attacks across the country. Already, the planned attack was several days late, and the materials Zhabnov wanted just weren't available. Between Vasily's priority requests for parts, jet, helicopter, ammunition, and large field equipment to fight the growing war on Russia's eastern and southern front, and Kilov's gradual commandeering of supplies over the last several years, 80% of Zhabnov's military materials were gone. The president's advisors were unsure whether to relay the startling information to their supreme commander or let it all lie buried in a storm of bureaucratic dust where it had been hidden. They opted for the latter. Who knew what the wrong revelations would mean to each one of them? A confrontation between Kilov and Zhabnov? Heads would roll no matter what, of that they were sure. Silence was the order of the day. Let others rake the muck. They were able to scrape together a facsimile of the forces the president had requested by pulling in other units from around the country. At last, they had assembled the strike force, 20 jets, 50 helicopters, and nearly 200,000 troops who would be conducting sweeps for undesirables in and around the United States. The entire event was to be kicked off with the command of the president himself from his military headquarters in Washington. Around the United States, the Red officers and troops waited impatiently, looking at their watches. They had been standing for nearly an hour and a half. Where was the great general? At 11:07, nearly 2 hours late, Zhabnov's limo slid into the space between his honor guard and his top generals.
Lavrov, everything is going just fine, I presume?
Absolutely, Mr. President. Our units are standing by all over the country, waiting for your command to begin their assault on the bandit forces. Operation Neutralization is on all burners, Mr. President.
Good, good, excellent. Well, let's get on then with the official ceremonies.
But, Mr. President, the troops are waiting to begin. The jets are standing by with their engines on.
In due time, Lavrov. This is a public display of force for all to see. Both American bandits and our own superiors in Moscow. There must be a certain amount of display for the media. Therefore...
He walked off to review the pink-cheeked honor guard, standing crisply at attention as reporters and TV crews filmed everything. Official staff publicity personnel followed closely behind Zhabnov, taking down his every word. After Zhabnov was satisfied that he had been photographed sufficiently, the president, surrounded by 40 of his top staff, headed over to the viewing station from which he would see the bombing force take off.
The best place to watch is from the control tower, Mr. President.
Very well, lead the way.
The fog through DC will pose no problem for our planes, Mr. President. And our reconnaissance advance teams tell us there's no fog over Union City.
Excellent, excellent. Now, let's get, as the Americans like to say, this show on the road. Where do I give the command so that all forces will begin their attacks?
Right here, Mr. President. Into this mic.
Ah. Ready? I'm about to give the command. Begin the attack!
The command tore across communication lines around the country, and over 250,000 Soviet personnel around the country began to carry out their plans of official murder. Zhabnov watched with satisfaction as the cockpit slammed shut on the waiting lines of jets. Sleek, rapier-nosed Magnoloy MiG-112s, two with N-bombs under their wings, 10 more flying shotguns. Zhabnov felt a thrill. This is what he had been missing. Command, action.
Now, here on this viewer, Mr. President, you will be able to see the attack just as the pilots see it from the air. A camera has been mounted in the nose of one of the jets carrying the bomb.
Wonderful. How innovative of you, Lavrov.
Lavrov, smiling broadly, turned the viewer on, and an image of the landscape from 10,000 feet burst onto the screen. Zhabnov watched in fascination as the rolling hills, the mosaics of fields of green and then black, passed the watchful eye of the camera. The jets found their target and dove, the angle of the camera banking sharply to the right. Zhabnov saw the bombs fall, and then the camera turned sharply away as the jets tore ass. In Union City, one of the largest free cities, the shotgun pistol factories were chugging away as over 60,000 people went about their daily business. The women and children hit the shelters as the men ran to their anti-aircraft stations. They had never been attacked before, but they were prepared. They hit one of the jets, but then two more dropped gleaming bombs. How large, they wouldn't know until... Zhabnov watched the bombs falling. The screen burst into overexposure, slowly fading away. The buildings were intact. The gates were intact. Some glass had shattered, but Union City was still there, instantly turned into a ghost town.
Excellent. Send a squadron to scour the remnants. See if we can't find clues to other cities' whereabouts.
But, Mr. President, the radiation would kill...
Calm down after a few days. The logistics of the operation do not concern me. That is, after all, your job.
Yes, Mr. President.
Of course. Kilov will learn to fear me as his natural superior. It is only fair.
The free fighters marched wearily on. The memory of their costly encounter with the Reds was still fresh in their minds. The wounds were still fresh on their bodies. Most of the men were back in form from the attack, except Perkins, whose lung didn't seem to be healing well at all. He tried to feign health, but his ghastly pallor and extreme fatigue were too obvious to ignore. Lang, too, was having problems from his burnt leg from the fiery crash of the drone. It had seemed to be healing at first, but now, on the fifth day, the leg was showing signs of deep infection, turning a ghastly purple color. Slade had done everything he could for the badly hurt men. Now it was up to God. They couldn't turn back, so Rock moved forward, the injuries weighing heavily on his mind. They passed more of the 40-foot towers every few miles, the structures mysterious and haunting, and totally inexplicable. The ground grew increasingly dark, moving from gray to charcoal black. Nothing lived here. Not a weed, not a thorny cactus, not a bird flew overhead.
Must have dropped 10 or 20 of the big boys right in this one area.
I doubt anything will ever grow here again. The very atoms of the ground look like they've been burnt.
They rode for hours in single file, the hybrids keeping up a slow, plodding pace. Even their powerful bodies were beginning to tire from the endless journey. And they had seen the deaths of their fellow Brids. The men sensed the skittishness of the Brids and treated them with kid gloves, speaking quietly and hardly using the reins at all. Rock knew they couldn't go on much longer like this, but there wasn't a drop of shade or cover in sight. They were down to extremely low water rations as it was. He scanned the horizon. It was all black, gnarled, twisted terrain, as if the moon had fallen onto the earth.
Wait!
What do you see?
Give me the binocs.
What's there?
It looks like some sort of bunker house about 2 miles off. Come on, let's scout it out.
The expedition veered to the left and made for the artificial structure. Rock's senses went on full alert, his ears picking up, his eyes narrowing. He felt something ahead, very close. He loosened his shotgun pistol in its holster, not taking it out, but leaving his hand resting lightly on top. Detroit, directly behind Rock, recognized the motion from years of missions with Roxon, and loosened his own gun, looking reflexively at his grenade belt to see what was readily available. There was a flurry of motion just ahead of them. A hatch seemed to open up out of the very earth, a round segment of blackness falling open. A small, bald, humanoid-looking creature jumped in front of them, holding a weapon.
Stop! I command you to cease motion!
What the...
The hybrid fell over onto its side as if dead, and Detroit rolled off as the Brid hit the ground in a motionless heap.
Wait, wait! We are friends! We're Americans like you. One of our men found one of your people about a month ago. He was hurt pretty bad.
Vorn? The quantity you speak of? Was that his designation, Vorn?
Yes, I think that's what Brady said.
Rock glanced over at Detroit, who seemed to be stirring slightly, and then immediately back at the pint-sized stranger, who grew nervous and fingered his weapon.
Yes, Vorn. He told my man he'd been attacked and then died. He gave our first expedition his weapon, a particle beam disintegrator. We've come nearly 1,000 miles to find you and to have you share what knowledge you have of such weapons with us so we can kick the goddamn Russians out of America.
The creature seemed extremely agitated, trembling bug-eyed as it listened to them suspiciously. Then it slowly lowered the pistol.
Americans. We are Americans, yes. We are the technicians. We're descended from the original crews that manned these silos.
It swept its arm across the nearly flat plain around them. Small, circular grooves could be seen everywhere. It had been a missile base, and a big one.
But we are all Americans. Come, please, all of you must subtract yourselves from your riding animals and accompany me down into the silos. I am Ullman. It is much more comfortable down there, although I'm afraid we can't provide sustenance.
Sustenance? Slade?
I think he means food, Rock.
Well, then, please share some of ours. We shot 3 boars several days ago and have enough for a feast, if you have water.
Yes, water. Follow me!
It led them forward down a slowly sloping ramp hidden from view by the black, sooty ground until they were right on top of it. At the bottom stood a corrugated steel door. They entered the corridor, single file, down the 4-foot-wide and about 8-foot-high cinder block tunnel, the Brid's big bodies barely able to squeeze through. Ullman walked about 5 paces ahead of Rock in the dimly lit tunnel. Some sort of built-in fluorescence shone down every 40 feet or so. The things looked ancient. The large-headed technician was dwarfed by Rock, who stood nearly 3 feet taller than it. He felt like he was walking behind a 4-year-old child. Yet the creature exuded a tremendous intelligence, a controlled mind.
Yes, that was Vorn your people found. He was our best hunter, or I should say our only hunter. We are, if you'll pardon the equation, E equals mass times food factor divided by age times 0.4367.
What was that?
Ah, yes, I see. Of course you can't know our terms. My apologies. We speak English, but we've probably elaborated on it over the years. We're all mathematicians and physicists, and have spent so many years together, our whole lives, that we've developed a kind of mathematical gang. I have to recalculate my grammar. We haven't had many guests around here. Not one in 100 years. We've been alone out here in the middle of this wasteland, developing our science. And dying.
The technician led them to a much larger open bunker, walls of cinder blocks piled a good 20 feet high. An old American flag still hung on one of the dusty walls, 20 shades grayer than it had been, but still the U.S. flag. Ullman pointed to a long metal railing that nearly surrounded the room, separating it from a 3-foot walkway that a century ago must have been patrolled by some sort of guard.
Here, attach your animals here. My people await upstairs in the computer analysis chamber. That's where we sustain life, as it is. We have not reproduced in this generation, and now we are reduced down to 31 of us and our last food. It is a pitiful state to be in. We were sitting up there together, watching the end of our race in slow motion, when your presence set off some of our alarms.
Well, I don't know about the end. But I don't think you'll die while we're here. We've got enough grub to feed a small army, and one of the best cooks this side of the Rockies. By the way, I'm Ted Roxon, representative of Century City. And these are my people. Detroit, Chen, Coughlin, Berger, Perkins, Slade, Erickson, Lang, and Archer.
Ah, Detroit, yes. I'm apologetic for using the particle beam on you.
My fault, pal. I shouldn't have gone for my gun so fast. Ooh, thing packs a nasty hangover.
Yes, But at that frequency, no permanent damage is done, I assure you.
We had no idea it could even shoot that way, even after our own scientists looked it over. How many settings do those things have?
All will be revealed in due time. Here we are. This ladder will take you to our home. Please, step carefully.
The shaft was some 30 feet in diameter and stretched from the concrete base 200 feet below to the steel hatch 150 feet above. Piping and electrical circuits ran like spider-like webs along the edges of the cylindrical metal tube.
This is where the missiles were?
Yes. That is a positive theorization.
You haven't got a few old spares lying around, do you? Can you imagine, Rock? If we could get our hands on 10 or 20 of these babies, the Reds wouldn't know what hit them. Probably ain't got no more defenses against missile attack. We could take out Moscow, Leningrad.
Unfortunately, I must reply in the negative. All the missiles were shot in the first hour of war. And from our information, which you are welcome to assimilate, the Soviets were able to shoot most of the U.S. strike from the skies using technology similar to our pistols.
So that's how they were able to survive the attack. All our data indicated that they shot down the missiles with some sort of super elaborate anti-missile system.
Schechter would be fascinated. It seemed to be extremely important information, though Roxon wasn't quite sure why. Ullman again started down the long silo ladder. Rock had McCoughlin and a few of the other men carry big sacks of food from their kitchen supplies in backpacks. They came shakily down the metal ladder, hanging on for dear life as the big loads of food, including two boar, shifted unnervingly on their backs. It would be the height of absurdity to have traveled 1,000 miles, to have fought off mutants, Reds, and everything else in this godforsaken part of America, and then be killed falling off a ladder. They came to the bottom of the long black metal track of rungs and started across a vast underground warehouse filled with electronics and equipment of long ago.
As you can see, Ted Roxon, we've let the place deteriorate. Factors have gotten quite bad over the last 10 years.
The door opened to reveal an entire group of small, bald people, all stirring in plastic chairs and blankets. They all looked emaciated beyond belief. It seemed that they were scared by the visitors, but too hungry to really care.
My fellow technicians, we have guests. They have food.
Hi, I'm Ted Roxon, and this here is Detroit.
I think we can save the introductions for after dinner.
Yeah, you're probably right. Here, man, put the chow down in that corner over there. McCoughlin, why don't you and Erickson get a fire going out there in the big storage room? Gotta be all kinds of old wood furniture you could use to get something started.
I can just use the stoves, Rock.
To barbecue a whole hog on a spit? These people need some livening, not to mention fattening up.
Oh, that kind of dinner. I got you. Archer, you're needed on work detail.
The huge bowman rose and accompanied the other two to gather wood for the bonfire that Erickson already had visualized. As McCoughlin, Erickson, and Archer were the largest free fighters in the expedition, they made quite a sight. Their 250 to 300 pound bodies, over 6.5 feet tall, barely fit through the technician's small entrance.
Here, while we're waiting, we have some canned juices and bread. Please, help yourself.
Moving slowly at first, so as not to appear desperate, the technicians headed slowly over to the table full of bounty. But by the time they reached it, they couldn't contain themselves. They reached down greedily and ripped chunks of bread, stuffing them in their mouths in huge pieces that they were barely able to swallow. They took tremendous gulps of the apple and orange juice. Rock looked on, remembering his own childhood days of hunger and how wonderful it had been to come into a free city and be given all that his growling stomach could hold. Ullman seemed embarrassed by the manners of his people and looked at Roxon.
We're usually not like this. I assure you, there aren't more well-mannered people on this planet than the technicians.
It's all right. I've been hungry myself, believe me. Very hungry. And I don't remember waiting politely when food was offered.
Whoa! Archer, what did you... This is jet fuel!